Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will happen when the Earth finally runs out of fossil fuels? Although they've supplied much of the energy that built the modern world and the energy that allows us to travel throughout that world, my guest today is confident we will still have electricity, planes, and cars even after burning through the planet's finite stores of petroleum, coal, and natural gas. Robert B. Laughlin is a Nobel laureate and Anne T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Physics at Stanford University. His new book is called Powering the Future: How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilizations of Tomorrow. Bob, welcome back to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So your sense is that looking deep into the future of energy strips the subject of political taint and of economic self-interest. Can you talk about how those things tend to get in the way of objective discussions when we're talking about the current time?
It's sort of self-evident, don't you think?
Yeah.
I can't think of anybody who isn't just enraged by the sort of dysfunctional conversation about this because it's so important. It's just that it's hybridized in some unhealthy way with taking people's money and using it for things.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's mixed up with social policies and tax policies in a way it shouldn't be. And so people just can't be rational about that because it's their own personal assets and so on and so forth.
You also think it's important for us to consider geologic time in order to really have perspective on what we're doing now and what things will look like in the future.
Yes. So if we are concerned about the Earth, which I myself am,
mm-hmm.
then you have to think about it on the Earth's terms. The Earth is a very, very old and venerable institution, and it's slower than we are. So we are born, live, die in the bat of an eyelash as far as the Earth is concerned. So, if you use 20% less fuel to save the Earth, this is a delusion because that merely means it takes 20% longer time to burn up all the fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
But that's long for us, but as far as the Earth is concerned, it's nothing. The end result is still the same, which is that you put all that carbon into the air.
So you think that the Earth will ultimately recover from any effects of the carbon dioxide emissions we've put out there in the last couple hundred years. I guess the question is, you know, that takes a long time. Will humankind be okay in the interim?
Well, I don't know, obviously,
mm-hmm.
Because I'll be dead long before it happens. One thing you can say pretty confidently is that people will be around. Now, it's a guess, but humans are the most successful form of life that's ever existed, and they're very adaptable, and you'd have to kill off every last one of them to prevent them from repopulating. So no, I think there's definitely going to be life around. And we could talk about getting from here to there, which might be a little rocky, but yes. Now, don't get me wrong, the worrying about hurting your environment is an issue for all time. I honestly think that even after the energy crisis has come and gone, people will still be talking about clean air and water and what sacrifices you have to make to get it.
And we have never yet discovered a fuel source that doesn't have trade-offs.
That's right. You can imagine such a thing. Let's see, I'm not sure I know how to answer this question. Energy, let me just write 15-second physics lesson. Energy
okay.
is a thing, okay? It's not a concept. It's a thing. You measure it. It has units of joules. And it's accompanied by something else that's measurable called entropy, which is kind of a degradation measure. And so energy is conserved. So the amount of it in the world, the universe, is constant. So you use the energy, and you degrade it, and then you have to throw it away like trash, which you do into space. Now, yes, I think those basic facts of life about using energy, kind of the way you use food, will never change.
So, although certainly you and I will not be around by the time the world runs out of petroleum, I have to tell you I was oddly relieved to see that you don't believe our ancestors will have to live without technology and modern transportation. We will find a way to power things like airplanes and cars without petroleum?
I think so. And, you know, why? All these things are guesses, of course, but it's my experiences living with people. They're very resourceful. We're very resourceful creatures. The jam we're in right now is a problem of costs. I'm reasonably confident that the technologies that will come online at that time already exist, in some nation form at least. And the reason you can't just snap your fingers and then have them now is that every one of us is greedy, and we want to get from here to there for the cheapest possible price. And as long as all of us are doing that, then it's cutthroat pricing, and the cheapest thing will win. So I see no problem, no blockage at all. I see that when the price is readjusted properly, I think probably some magic will happen that will just take your breath away.
Which has been the holdup a lot of people have felt with solar taking a greater role, because it still cost effectively is not as good a deal financially for people as powering homes with coal generated electricity.
Right. Out here we use natural gas more, but it's the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
So those fuels are you use them because they're dirt cheap. And then you ask, well, why not just pay more for electricity? Well, we had a nice episode on that out here, as, by the way, did you in Texas during deregulation, where energy prices began to go up because of deregulation, and suddenly governments began to fall.
Hmm.
Nobody, but very few people are actually willing to put up with higher electricity prices to save the world. It's sad but true.
Why is it that you think that in the future we will maybe pay less for the energy that we need to power our homes than we do for getting around town, which is the opposite of the way things are right now?
It's actually simple. It has to do with it. Let me answer it in parallel. It has to do with a question I asked students about cars and airplanes. So I say, will people in the future drive cars? And usually they say yes after a while,
mm-hmm.
basically because people want them. Then I say, well, how about airplanes? That's a little harder, but then they say, yes, there'll be some airplanes, at least for somebody to fly in. And then I say, well, what will power them? And there we have an excellent science discussion, because it so happens that jet fuel and gasoline and diesel fuel, mainly alkanes, have the greatest energy density per volume mass that is allowed by physical law.
Hmm.
There will never be fuels better than those things, ever. Now, people ask me, how can you predict what will ever be so? Well, of course, you can't with 100% certainty, but this is a bet, right? I'm willing to put every dime that I have on this bet, because I'm pretty sure the laws in question have been in force since before people walked the earth. Now, that, in turn, means that in this time, in the future, there have to be synthetic fuels that work the same as the ones you use now. They just don't come out of petroleum anymore. You make them from something else. That is going to be expensive, because the carbon to make them will have to be drawn out of the air. Now, so there's a whole expense issue of the fuels you need to fly an airplane. But meanwhile, while all that's taking place, something else is taking place in the electricity industry, namely, the price of electricity is capped by nuclear power. I don't honestly know whether people will have nuclear power in the future or not. Nobody likes it right now. But when push comes to shove, I'm pretty sure no one will eschew nuclear power simply because it's good.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be a time when people have to, there'll be a shakeout in the electricity industry. And the cheapest one will win, but I think you can predict with great certainty that whatever it is won't be more expensive than nuclear power.
I think it's fascinating when you're going out into the future to consider the fact that even nuclear power is a finite resource, at least based upon the current fuels that we know exist on this planet.
Yes, it is, and that's been talked about a lot. The way you use nuclear power right now only uses a small fraction of it, and there's a reason why. Namely, the other ways of using nuclear energy are more and more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, more and more dangerous for the plutonium proliferation and so on. So yes, the total amount of energy, joules in the ground, estimated by, let us say, the U.S., the European Atomic Energy Agency, total amount of joules in the ground right now, of uranium, the way we burn it today, is about one-third of the amount of joules of coal in the ground.
Hmm.
That means that if you step up nuclear energy use, which I don't think will happen, but if you step it up right now, the nuclear energy poops out about the same time the coal does.
So you see carbon-based fuels as forever the main course of our energy options. Why are carbon fuels so ideal for meeting human needs in a way that other sources of energy are not?
They're lightweight and don't take up much room, and they're safe.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that there's a simple physics idea, I can tell you. Energy in a certain volume, okay? Energy per unit volume has another unit, which is called pressure. So if you squish a bunch of energy into a unit volume, it takes pressure to do that. Now, the way chemical energy works is that pressure is supplied by the beautiful quantum mechanics of chemical bonds. Namely, they're tight, tight, tight little springs. And so they squish all those atoms together and store energy that way. But the beauty of the carbon kind is that the springs can't come undone unless there's oxygen around.
Hmm.
So you've got this stupendous amount of energy stored, but it's not going to hurt you. To put this in perspective, there's an oil depot north of here in Point Richmond, in the Bay Area here. You can do a little calculation. What would happen if all the oil at that oil depot were to atomize into the atmosphere and then someone would strike a match? It's many nuclear bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it would decimate San Francisco. But that won't ever happen because you can't atomize it into the air.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so it's compact and safe, and then add one more thing. Even though we're demonizing carbon dioxide lately, human beings generate waste. And it turns out that carbon dioxide is the only kind of waste we generate that is not harmful to the earth. Now, it's a greenhouse gas for sure, and it heats things up, but it's not poisonous. Plants use it to make their bodies, and it gets recycled. So after you're done using this fuel, this lightweight fuel, it goes out and gets reused.
So will we in the future have to continue dealing with our carbon dioxide emissions long after we have used up whatever we're pulling from the ground?
No. The reason is as simple as that the carbon, any carbon that's in your fuels, has to come out of the air because that's where it all is.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay money to get the carbon back out of the air. And the amount of energy, you have to expend energy to get it back out, and the energy you have to expend is more the same as the amount of energy you got by burning it in the first place. So the carbon-based fuels in this future time aren't primary sources of energy anymore. They're storage mediums.
Nobel laureate Robert B. Laughlin is my guest. He's professor of physics at Stanford University and author of the new book, Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilizations of Tomorrow. We invite you to join the conversation now. We have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. And remember, you can interact with fellow Think listeners online by going to the Think page of kera.org. Click on today's show topic and leave your comments there.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nobel laureate Robert B. Laughlin. He's professor of physics at Stanford and author of the new book Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilizations of Tomorrow. You can join the conversation by emailing think at kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Bob, as you say, one thing we can do is to pull carbon from the air and then create our energy from that. Obviously, a great way that nature already does this is through growing plants. What will we need to do in the future to create energy from carbon that we have grown in plants without endangering the food supply?
I'm going to answer that, but I need to correct you.
Oh, okay.
Well, no, it's all right. Getting the carbon out of the air doesn't get energy. It costs energy.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
So one of the key points in this book is that the carbon budget and the energy budget are going to be different things. They're not right now. Carbon, you just get it out of the ground, you burn it, and that makes energy. But when the carbon isn't there in the ground anymore, it turns upside down. And so energy can be supplied by other by other means, but it has a price cap on it. But meanwhile, you have to pay energy, you have to pay money to get the carbon back out to make the storage medium with which you're going to power your airplanes and your cars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yes, the my guess is that the best way to do that will turn out to be the best way to do that right now, which is with agriculture. Because why? Well, because the plants are professional carbon taker outers. And they've been honing this technology for approximately 3 billion years. And they're really good at it. They're really good at what they do. And my guess is that a bunch of scientists are never going to beat them. Now, let's assume for the sake of discussion that that's true and that you've got to get carbon from somewhere as a raw material for industrial purposes, including fuels. Well, we know because of modern-day numbers that there's a food supply issue there. Let me give you a nice number. If you take the entire U.S. corn crop and burn it, which is the most energy you can get out of it, if I remember my numbers correctly, that amount of energy is about a third, something like a third of our carbon or oil budgets, which means about 10% of the total energy budget of the country. In other words, it's way, way, way too little. And in addition to that, of course, you don't have any food. So in this future time, I'm predicting that there will grow up a second industrial sector based on salt water. So the saltwater agriculture can't be used for food, so there's no competition with freshwater food supplies. On the other hand, there are plenty of plants that grow prolifically in salt water, including saltwater algae. There are lots of them. Okay? And so when this time comes, my guess is that the deserts and the oceans will be where the carbon supplies come from, not the lands that we presently farm for food. The size of this agriculture, is it big enough? Yes. Oceans, it turns out, are tremendously prolific with plant life. You just don't see it because you're not out there, but they're very fecund. And so it's perfectly feasible to do it. The reason we don't do it now is because the stuff you're growing is functionally equivalent to coal, and you just can't beat the coal people for price.
Mm-hmm. Can we engage in this kind of global scale saltwater agriculture without messing up the oceans, as it were, and threatening biodiversity there?
No. At least I don't think so. I think personally that this energy problem is going to come and go, and then for thousands of years beyond that, people will be struggling with the trade-off between the demands they make on the land and oceans, on the one hand, and the needs of the earth. In other words, that's an issue for all time, whereas our energy problem is something that's pretty immediate. So no, I think there will always be trade-offs, and you're going to, anytime you exploit the earth for anything, there is going to be some environmental trade-off, and you're going to have to cost it out and see what makes sense to you and what doesn't.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Our first caller is Andre, calling from DFW Airport. Hi, Andre.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I love what I'm hearing from you guys.
Okay.
Question. What about blue energy?
And which is blue?
Yeah, blue energy.
What is that?
Oh, wow. Wait a minute, you're a laureate. It's energy used that does not emit carbon or anything like that, but it is way more vast. Also, what I have a question about is, if I have developed an engine that will replace all combustion engines, do you suppose anyone in the industry would be interested?
Okay.
I want to stop and listen.
Jay, these are great questions. There are two of them. So let's deal with the first one first. The various sources of energy, as I said, energy is a thing. And you're quite right that there are other sources of it other than digging stuff out of the ground and burning it. So the issue I try to get on the table with people as a scientist is, no, you can't, this is not a technical problem. You have to look at how much things cost. It's a cost fight, okay? Now, is there enough energy supply to supply your energy after the coal and oil run out? Yes, there's way more than enough. There are lots of different possibilities. There's lots of geothermal, but the one you always point to as the roof on it is the sun. There's enough sunlight falling on the Sahara alone to power the world many times over. So yes, there's, if you call it blue energy, which is, say, non-brown energy, there's tons of it. It just costs a lot. So yeah, I think there's going to be a struggle when the coal and oil runs out. There's going to be a struggle among them, and whichever one is the cheapest will wipe out all the others, and then that's what you'll have. Now, let's see. My brain is not working. There was a second piece of your question.
He said if he were to, Andre said if he were to invent a non-combustion engine.
Oh. The combustion engines that we have now, we use them. Why? Because they're incredibly cheap. You ask, how much does the engine in your car cost? Well, you buy them new for about $2,000, but the production cost is some number much less than that. So the basic issue with combustion engines is that you get an immense amount of power for not very much capital cost. There are lots of other things you can have that use the fuel more efficiently or make less noise and so on, but they all cost more. And therein lies the issue. So this is another example of your costing problem. Now, my guess is that plain old burning, which is what we do now, it's going to be hard to beat that. For a long list of reasons. You know, people thinking about batteries and fuel cells and so forth. But I think there's going to be, it's a real long shot kick out of the saddle conventional burning. But we'll see.
Occasionally in these discussions, someone will call in and extol the virtues of the energy we could get from hydrogen. Why is this not a good solution to our problems?
Oh, it's very simple. Hydrogen's a pain in the neck. No, it's actually very simple. Hydrogen, it's the energy storage issue only. So hydrogen has more energy stored per mass, per weight, than anything else. So it's really good. And the reason for this is that hydrogen is very light. The bad news, however, it's also puffy. Even when you liquefy it at ultra-cold temperatures, which is, of course, highly dangerous because that stuff will burn you, it still can't get anywhere near the energy per volume of ordinary gasoline. Not only that, so there's a storage problem. There are other ways to store hydrogen, but they all have technical issues with them. For example, you can put them in hydrogen and metals and store lots and lots of hydrogen and metals, but the metals are heavy.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
So it's basically a convenience of use issue. And then let's throw in one more thing. Hydrogen blows up. So students often ask me, when are we going to have hydrogen-powered airplanes? And I say, great, you can be the first one to fly on it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Michael in Fort Worth. Hey, Michael.
Hi. Dr. Loftin, you were just talking about hydrogen storage problem, but what about using hydrogen fuel through electrolysis and just make the hydrogen as you go?
You can do that, and a lot of people are talking about it. And so I mentioned one thing, that hydrogen as a substance is a kind of nuisance substance to work with. Gasoline and diesel fuel are vastly better as for handling purposes. Then there's another technical issue which we don't talk a lot about, but it's a big problem. That's the electrode. I mean, the weakness of all electrochemical things, including your batteries, is where the metal meets the fluids.
Mm-hmm.
There's always some corrosion that happens there. Every battery that I ever owned failed because of the electrodes. It didn't fail because the energy was gone out of the battery. It was sort of the engine, which is to say the electrodes have a degradation problem with them. And the same is true with hydrogen. There's a cost issue of maintaining the electrode. Now, let's add one more thing. It turns out that natural gas is mostly hydrogen. Natural gas, which just comes out of the ground, has so much hydrogen in it that when you go to the store to buy hydrogen, the way they make it is they take natural gas and take the carbon out.
Hmm.
That's the way industrial people make it. So you might ask, well, while you're making hydrogen, why not just make some natural gas, make some methane? And yeah, that makes perfect sense. But once you get there, you say, well, why not go the whole route and make a diesel fuel? It's not much more difficult. So I'm being a little windy here, but once you start talking about making stuff with electricity, you quickly slide down to the conclusion that what you should be making is diesel,
mm-hmm.
not hydrogen.
What sort of progress do you see us making in improving energy storage? Because this is a big problem. You know, we have lots of sun and lots of wind here in Texas, but the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine.
Absolutely, and this is what you might call the central problem of alternate energy. There are fundamental physics reasons why storing energy is hard. Storing electricity in particular is hard. And the fact that people haven't got a good solution to this problem yet does not mean they're stupid. It just means that it's very profound. Right now, the only really good way to do it is by pumping water uphill. And that's pretty good, actually. You get 80% round-trip efficiency. You get most of your energy back. The downside, of course, is that you use up land and there are public use issues. And, of course, if you're in Texas where there aren't a heck of a lot of mountains, then you got a problem. Okay. Well, so there are lots of startup companies now that are worrying about energy storage, particularly with something called flow batteries. I myself investing a lot of time thinking hard about the storage problem. I've got some ideas, but of course I won't talk about them on the air because I want to make some money.
Good for you.
But absolutely, right, without that, the wind can't come. We can't have wind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The problem is that electricity, the value of electricity depends on when it comes. And the value of electricity when you need it is between 10 and 100 times more valuable than the electricity that comes when you don't need it. So timing is everything, and without the storage, the wind has a monstrous problem, which I personally think can't be overcome.
We'll go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time, Ash is on the line in Plano. Hello, Ash.
Yeah, Dr. Loftin, it's
Hi, Ash.
To hear from you. I want to tell you something, or I would like to comment on something. Back in 70s, remember when the first energy crisis started and the oil embargo
The
crisis started going up. At that time, if you remember, I was a graduate student at Purdue, and Dr. Hans Bethe and a couple of Nobel Prize winners came there, and they talked about the alternate source of energy, nuclear, and they were telling that the oil and gas will run out by the 2000 or 2005. Well, that's not true anymore. The funny thing is, they never talked about the hybrid cars, They never talked about the possibility of an electric car, which both came in the last. And the hybrid cars are very effective car, as you know that. If everyone was driving Prius in the country, think about how much energy we will save. But leave that aside. Second thing is, back in 87, Paul Chew came up with a compound, just looking at the periodic table, which was superconductive at a 100 degree higher than the liquid helium. And I worked with Dr. Keesum, whose father, along with Kamerlingh Onnes, discovered superconductivity. And don't you think there is a possibility in the periodic table where we could have a compound which is superconducting at a room temperature, and then a lot of the storage and those problems will be so very easy to solve?
What do you think, Bob?
Well, there's lots of stuff. First of all, I was a graduate student at MIT at the same time. And I remember I was trying to get a job, and there was no gas. So I remember that. I remember that time very well. Hans Bethe came to talk about nuclear energy and made wrong predictions. This happens when you make predictions. Sometimes they are wrong. Hans was a powerful proponent of nuclear energy, and I think he just wasn't able to foresee the events that happened in the late 20th century, in particularly the political backlash against nuclear power. Now, Bethe's work, by the way, is terrific, and everything Hans Bethe ever wrote is crystal clear and worth reading. So there's a lot of truth in what he said. However, the reality that we have on the ground right now is that natural gas is plentiful, and coal, and people would just rather burn that than have nuclear plants, as a rule.
Let me jump in here, Bob, because we need to take a break, and I want to make sure you have time to finish answering Ash's question. My guest is Nobel laureate Robert B. Laughlin, who is professor of physics at Stanford University and author of the new book Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilizations of Tomorrow. After the break, we will take more of your emails to think@kera.org and more of your calls to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Stanford University physics professor Robert B. Laughlin is our guest this hour. His book is called Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilizations of Tomorrow. And before the break, Bob, you were responding to Ash, who had talked about superconductivity at room temperature and the potential fuel-saving implications of having everybody driving electric and hybrid vehicles. Continue with your answer, if you would.
Yes. I thought about this over the break. I can answer, I think, a little more tersely and on point. What we're talking about is technologies that use energy more efficiently, mostly. Now, with electric cars, we might be talking about anti-pollution efforts as well, but let's keep on point and talk about more efficiency. The catch-22 of this conversation is that energy is cheap. Now, people's behavior when they go out and live tends to be to do the cheapest thing. Not always. Some people do their best to be good to the environment, but most people, and I include myself a lot, will do the cheapest thing. Now, it turns out that energy is so cheap that it's cheaper to buy more fuel and burn it in a cheaper engine than it is to buy a very efficient engine. In other words, the marginal value to you of having more expensive machinery that is more efficient is too low. Were the price of fuel to be very high, that would turn upside down, and greater efficiency of machines would be something you'd think about. But right now, most everybody I know just dismisses the conversation instantly because they do the calculation and they think, well, you know, I can just buy more gas and gas is cheap. So let's not talk about this at all. So that's the problem you face as a technologist trying to work on the efficiency side of things. That you're fighting a very powerful economic factor, which is that the energy is cheap.
And as to the question about superconductivity at room temperature, is there potential for that?
Oh, I think so. Probably not in my lifetime, but yes, there's nothing that I can think of that would stop it, and it's getting there. Okay. Now, that said, will it matter? There's an interesting fact. You can go into the electric industry and see where they have their losses. It turns out that resistive loss, the thing that superconductivity beats, is just not a factor. Electric generators are something like 97% efficient just with ordinary metals. Electric power transmission lines, long-haul transmission lines, have aluminum lines in them. The total resistive loss in them is only about 7% for the longest ones. And why is it that? Well, because they make a price calculation with the cost of the amount of aluminum they have to put in the air to get less loss. And they say, well, the value of the electricity I'm transmitting is too low to justify the extra cost of the extra metal. But it's perfectly possible without superconductivity to make those transmission losses as little as you want. In other words, the things that superconductivity deals with, makes better, have already been marginalized to some extent by the remarkable properties of ordinary metals. So I don't have a lot of hope myself for superconductivity radically changing the electric power industry.
We have an email here from Tim who wants to know if you know about the status of a perpetual motion generator of power and why it doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's a great question. Perpetual motion is a buzzword. And what it means is that you're beating this thing that we call entropy, this fact that when you use energy, you degrade it a little bit. Now, that degradation, as far as anybody knows who studied it, including myself, is a law of nature. In other words, the reason you can't beat it is that it's a law of nature. However, it's a very ironic thing. It's one of those laws of nature that is emergent. That is to say, it involves many, 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 many particles doing something together. So it's not provable. It's not provable mathematically. It just sort of is. Now, one of the weird consequences of that is that it opens the door to fraud. And now, unfortunately, you can't say that something is that you think is fraudulent is fraud because you get sued. So it turns out that the Department of Commerce has an entire office filled with people who are physically testing machines sent to the U.S. Patent Office that allege to get energy out of nowhere. They can't just say, oh, it's obvious you can't do that because it's a law of nature. The lawyer will put you on the stand and say, can you prove this law?
Hmm.
And the person has to say, well, no. And then the lawyer says, well, what are you talking about? So, yes, a perpetual motion, I think, will be perpetually with us because it's just one of those neat things of nature that isn't mathematically provable. It just is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Jack in Irving. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I have a question. I'm going to modify it slightly. I was initially wondering about storage of energy systems and their inefficiencies. But my question is related now. I've changed it since I've listened to the discussion. Is the debate social versus economic? That is to say, the people who want alternate energy sources are arguing a social point, like it's environmentally responsible to go to solar or whatever problem, and the people who are arguing the economics are saying, as long as this stuff is cheap and available, we ought to stick with it. It's more of a debate between what the producers of energy are saying about their economics of it versus the people who are considering it purely in social terms rather than economic?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And this is one of the reasons that I wrote this book and also why I set it with a science fiction premise. When many people talk about energy, they're actually not talking about energy at all. They're talking about social justice or justice to the earth. And saying, in effect, well, those things are so important that you can pass laws abrogating the laws of economics. Now, I guess I'm got some years on me now, and I don't think you can do that. I think governments have sure tried, and it's not just not socialist governments either. It's all of them, including our own, who've tried to modify pricing, you know, and pass laws that change the pricing rules, and they don't stick. The reason they don't stick is simply that people cheat. And this, by the way, it will amuse you. This, the same dynamic occurs in communist countries as well. It's exactly the same. So regulating, you know, passing laws that saying that this is not worth X when it really is, turns out not to work very well. Now, so yes, it's a political debate about that. Namely, can you pass laws to change pricing and therefore people's behavior? Now, what I want to do as a scientist is kind of step around that. Okay? I don't have a special expertise to talk about what the law should be and how economics ought to work. I just have some anecdotal information, having lived, how I think it works. And also, I know lots and lots about the technologies in question. So that's what I prefer to talk about.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Irving, where we have Rakesh on the line. Hi, Rakesh.
Hi. Fascinating topic. My question is, where does nuclear fission fit into this?
What a great question. You probably know that there are very advanced fusion experiments now going on at the Livermore Lab, where, incidentally, I used to work. And we all have our fingers crossed that these guys can do it this time, although it ain't over till it's over. And it's turning out that these experiments are very tough to do. And so who knows, maybe it'll come this time and maybe it won't. Now, that said, there's a dirty little secret of fusion that most people don't know, but I'll tell you, which is that it's a breeding technology. The energy that comes out of fusion is very small compared to the amount of energy that comes out of fission. And what's worse, it comes out in a bad way, namely as a very, very fast neutron. Neutrons go through things, and they don't hit stuff. Okay? And so, first of all, they're dangerous, but second of all, they don't deposit heat very well. What neutrons are extremely good at, however, is converting useless uranium-238 into plutonium. And so when you do that, when you use the neutron for that, you get instantly 10 times more energy out than you would have gotten just with the neutron alone. And if you encounter knock-on breeding, it's somewhere between 10 and 100. So, you know, you guess in the future, suppose the fusion happens, will those people of the future throw away 99% of their energy just to rid the world of fission dirt? My guess is no, especially when energy is tight. And therefore, fusion, when and if it comes, won't be a clean alternative to fission. It'll be a route to more fission. I hope I've answered your question.
You don't think that there is some undiscovered source of energy on the planet that we are not at least aware of as a potential source of energy?
Well, in science, the first rule is that you stop talking about beliefs as soon as you can. Okay? You talk about what's measured.
Okay.
Energy is a very primal thing. It's very simple. And so you know what it is. You know where it is. It's heat. There's heat in the interior of the Earth. And there's K chemical energy, and there's tons of energy streaming down from the sun. Okay. So, as I said before, we're not talking about whether there's enough of it. We're talking about what price it will be. Now, nuclear energy is a sort of historical anomaly in that it was very unexpected, and people thought, well, it's sort of magic. It isn't magic. It's the same thing as chemistry. It just happens inside a nucleus. And the upshot of all the big accelerator experiments that have been done since the Second World War is that there isn't anything beyond it. And there is no super weapon-type energy storage stuff at length scales smaller than the atomic nucleus. It's just kind of a desert up there. In addition, you look what happened with nuclear energy. It's becoming marginalized now because it's dangerous. Why? Well, it's what I said. You put lots of energy in a small space. That means lots of pressure. In this case, it's the pressure inside an atomic nucleus. And then bad stuff begins to happen. In this case, the bad stuff is that little particles come out of there at the speed of light, and they are capable of hurting you.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I'm based on what I know about the laws of physics, including nuclear energy and everything you could imagine beyond nuclear energy, I say no, that the lay of the land in centuries from now, when carbon is gone, is the same as it is now.
Is there anything that we can be doing in the current time to help avoid the possibility of violence as we make this transition from the fossil fuel era to whatever will come after?
What a great question. One of the conclusions I came to, and I don't like to talk about it because it's not polite, okay, is that the real issue on the table with an energy conversation is not having enough energy. It's avoiding bloodshed when the transition happens. In other words, it's managing the transition properly. Now, I'm not 100% sure that it needs to be managed. It might be smooth enough and slow enough that it would happen perfectly fine by itself peacefully. That said, however, history shows what usually happens when human beings don't have enough of something. They choose to try to take it from their friends. And that's a polite way of saying that they engage in warfare. And yes, I think it's definitely the case that energy is a sufficiently important thing that people will engage in warfare. I want to keep this discussion in the future for obvious reasons.
Robert B. Laughlin is professor of physics at Stanford. His new book is called Powering the Future. Bob, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to all of you for listening and all of you who have contributed to KERA and to Think during the recent membership campaign. On this show, you were able to help us raise $47,189. We appreciate that. My name's Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.